Like an hour, but I can get from Dubai. It was great.
Good afternoon, everyone. I call this meeting of the Tax Committee to order. First order of business is approval of the minutes from our February 28th meeting. Representative Smith, would you like to move the minutes from the February 28th meeting?
I would love to. I move to approve the minutes from the last meeting.
Any discussion on the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The minutes are approved. Next, we are going to bring back up the House File 1938 that we heard yesterday. So the chair moves that House File 1938, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So, members, we're going to wrap up some of the public testimony that we didn't quite finish yesterday. And we've got about four or five folks left on the list. And then at that point, Commissioner Marquardt will come back up. We'll have plenty of time for member discussion. So please, you know, hold any questions related to the bill and its substance until that time. And first up on our list of public testifiers, we have Bradley Peterson. And on deck is Ryan Hamilton. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and organization for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bradley Peterson, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And as always, it's a great day to talk about our highest priority local government aid. As you know, LGA helps cities across the state, and particularly in Greater Minnesota, provide high-quality public services and infrastructure that our residents and businesses rely on and expect. Just as inflation has put pressure on individuals and families, it has also increased the cost of everything that a city does. Through increased salary and benefit costs, gas for city vehicles, and material costs for maintenance and upkeep of city infrastructure. At the same time, LGA has receded as a share of the state's budget. And I think Mr. Jessen mentioned the stat yesterday of it used to be 4% of the state's general fund budget in the early 2000s, and it's now hovering above 2%. The other side of that equation is the growth in the state budget. Since 2009, the state budget has increased by 39%. So by any measure, whether you're looking at inflation or as a share of the state budget, local government aid has simply not kept up. In terms of the LGA provisions in this bill, we appreciate the inclusion of an appropriation increase and the formula updates that we have worked on with our colleagues at the League of Cities, Metro Cities, and the Small Cities Organization. We also appreciate that the governor has been responsive to concerns we have expressed over the appropriation level contained in this proposal, and we look forward to working with both the administration and the legislature to get to a number that we feel meets our needs. We continue to support the approach contained in Representative Liz Lagarde's bill, HF 1377, which calls for $150 million appropriation. Additionally, HF 1377 provides an ongoing inflation adjustment to the appropriation, which will allow for more stability and predictability in the program. And with that, I appreciate your time and thanks for letting me take the chance to talk to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Next up is Ryan Hamilton. On deck is John Thorson. Mr. Hamilton, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and organization for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Ryan Hamilton, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Catholic Conference. Mr. Chair, Chair Gomez, members of the committee, the commitment to make Minnesota the best state in the country for kids to grow up is a bedrock of common ground. The best state for children is a state that acknowledges the irreplaceable role that families play in children's lives. Lawmakers can propel Minnesota to number one by ensuring families have the resources they need to create and sustain healthy environments for child rearing. Family economic security should be the top priority in state and tax policy deliberations because families are doing the most important work of raising our next generation. We are very pleased, very grateful, that the governor and the lieutenant governor have included a child tax credit as a prominent feature in their administration's budget proposal. Far from being a handout, this form of tax relief lowers the overall cost of government for a group of people who are making a decisive contribution to society amidst economic pressures that we continue to hear about. This proposal is a good marker. The great thing about this concept is that it's scalable. We encourage the legislature to look closely at Article 1, Section 17, Subdivisions 1, 2, and 3, and continue exploring proposals that would make this good, great CTC even better. While we fully support the impact that child tax credits can have on lifting children out of poverty, we also believe a CTC can be more than just an anti-poverty tool. A more inclusive CTC could be a solution to multiple issues that Minnesota is facing, including our long-term workforce and population concerns. It could be a catalyst for new families to be formed or move into our state. A sustainable workforce, a vibrant communities, and a sustainable tax base are all produced by economically secure families. And from the family perspective, the governor's CTC could be even better if it was expanded to cover children who have stay-home parents, children of first responders, children of teachers, children of nurses, children of mechanics and tradespeople. The anti-poverty impact will not be diminished by including children of families from those economic demographics. We hope that what emerges from your deliberations is a CTC that leads the nation in the number of households and children that receive a fully refundable direct credit. That's the type of policy that will make Minnesota the best state in the nation to live, work, and raise families. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Next up is John Thorson, and on deck is Eric Harris Bernstein. Mr. Thorson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and organization for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is John Thorson. I'm Legislative Director for LIUNA Minnesota, North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union, representing more than 13,000 skilled construction laborers who build and maintain our roads, highways, bridges, and the basic utilities our communities need to thrive in every corner of the state. I'm here to voice our support for a handful of provisions in the governor and lieutenant governor's tax proposal that's before you today. First, at $5.85 billion, this is a large tax bill, but it makes a considerable effort to lift up Minnesota's families, workers, retirees, and make investments that move our state forward. I'd like to start by saying we support the governor's approach to the exemption of Social Security benefits. We believe it's right-sized and it's targeted best to Minnesotans that need it most. We also support the surcharges on capital gains and dividends of individuals, trusts, and estates over $500,000 and $1 million. We thank the administration for including $30 million increases to both local government aid and county program aid, and the public safety funding included in this bill. These are measures that keep property taxes down, and they maintain strong public services throughout the state. We also support the sales tax exemption that streamlines for construction materials purchased by local governments and nonprofit organizations. It's no secret that Minnesota has fallen behind in maintaining our water infrastructure and our roads and bridges. This measure will stretch the value of a dollar committed to local and regional construction projects that fix or replace aging municipal infrastructure that is either at or near its capacity, or in some cases beyond its useful life. Now, for example, the PCA reports the need for an estimated 822 water infrastructure projects at a cost of $5.3 billion over the next 20 years. It's also time to fix, catch up, and keep up our roads, bridges, and transit. Minnesota has thousands of miles of roads in poor condition. More than 600 structurally deficient bridges, and our transit systems around the state are facing a fiscal cliff. In addition to driving regional economic growth and prosperity, these are critical projects that will launch thousands of careers through registered union apprenticeship programs that the construction industry relies on to produce a skilled and safe, efficient trades workforce. I want to thank, again, the governor and lieutenant governor for including these provisions in their tax proposal. They provide for investments we can count on to make life better for millions of Minnesotans while creating and maintaining thousands of good-paying union jobs, and will move our state forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thorson. And our final public testifier is Eric Harris Bernstein. Mr. Bernstein? Please state your name and organization for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Norris, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today to testify on House File 1938. For the record, my name is Eric Bernstein, and I am director of We Make Minnesota, which is a coalition of labor and community groups united in support for the foundational investments that we make together collectively through our state budget. We represent nurses, healthcare workers, laborers, many other public sector workers that keep our state running. This bill makes substantial investments in Minnesota's families and children, and I appreciated yesterday Commissioner Marquardt's comments on the widespread and long-term benefits of poverty reduction and early childhood welfare. We do not oppose these investments, but I'm here today to share our concerns about the ongoing reduction of the tax base occurring within this bill. We are worried that sort of funding programs through tax cuts and tax credits in the long run impedes our ability to fund important public institutions that Minnesotans rely on and cherish. State revenues in Minnesota have declined as a share of the total state economy since 1990, and many public services, many of which we've heard about in the course of this hearing, are underfunded. We need money for schools and teachers, hospitals. Many cities need money, and so does our infrastructure, as we just heard. We think that these public investments do enormous good and that the surplus would be well used to ensure that all Minnesotans can access and secure their basic collective needs like housing, health care, quality education, and transit. We are concerned about $1.4 billion in ongoing tax cuts, which is really $2 billion offset by $600 million in revenue raised by the governor's proposal on capital gains. However, we do greatly appreciate the governor's measured approach to Social Security exemption. Two-thirds of all Social Security income in Minnesota is already exempt from taxation, and around 600,000 out of 1.1 million Minnesota Social Security recipients pay no taxes on their benefits and thus would receive no benefit from this or any other Social Security tax cut plan. Seniors, just like everyone else, consume public goods and services, rely on them for nursing homes, transit, roads, just like everyone else. We think it's appropriate that they should contribute something. And as session goes on, we are looking to all of you to protect the tax base going forward, which will help keep us from more tax increases in the future and ensure that our state institutions are well funded. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. All right. That concludes the public testimony portion of our hearing. At this point, we'll
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's customary sometimes to at least offer an opportunity for folks that maybe didn't pre-register to the crowd.
All right. Before we move on to the member discussion, is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify? All right, seeing none, we will move on then to member discussion. I'm going to invite Commissioner Marquardt back up to the testifiers' table to be available for questions, and we'll open it up to members for questions or discussion. Yes, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Nice to see you again, Commissioner and Madam Chair. I apologize because I'm going to have to run out to another hearing in a minute. So I just wanted to ask, one of the concerns I have is that the tax increase, the payroll tax for family medical leave does not seem to be in the governor's proposal. Will you plan to add that as an amendment, or when will, I realize there isn't a fiscal note on that bill yet, so maybe that's why you're holding off, but I would love to know, you know, how that's going to get incorporated into this final tax bill.
Commissioner Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Paul Marquardt, Revenue Commissioner. And thank you, Representative Robbins. So that's kind of a jurisdictional question. So it would relate to something like unemployment insurance where you have a certain cost going in. So typically, I don't know if that would ever be under the jurisdiction of the tax committee. I understand what's happening there, but in the past, and if it is, it hasn't come forward yet, but I think it would be treated somewhat like I said, unemployment insurance and some of these other types that are not under the realm of the tax committee.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Robbins. Just, you know, obviously sort of the House or the DFL House is moving that bill also, and then the governor has their approach. So I just wanted to mention to you that because of the way, so there's sort of like, I think because it's a payroll tax, and we have sort of traditionally in taxes not heard like UI bills, and paid family medical leave is making, I don't know how many stops, a lot of stops in a lot of committees, right? So by the end of it, most members will have had a crack at it or will have had the chance to look into it more closely. And we have had a conversation, and so far I have waived bringing it to taxes because of sort of the way that traditionally in the House, at least as long as I've been here, is like we haven't heard those payroll tax UI bills. So I also don't have an intention to move those provisions from paid family medical leave into the omnibus tax bill, but sort of to let it do its own thing as a standalone, but just FYI.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Marquardt, I appreciate that. So I have also not been here, we're same class. So if it doesn't come through the tax committee on the UI taxes, what committee would have jurisdiction over this if we're not treating it as a regular tax? It just, you know, because I want to make sure somebody's hearing that. And if not, if no one's going to hear it, I would request that you bring it before us, because it's a huge change. And I think it's something that the, you know, tax or similar committee should have eyes on.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday we talked a little bit about and maybe similar to the question on the payroll tax of over $2 billion. The motor vehicle tab tax increase, I think it's like a 60% increase in the tabs, and then also a metro sales tax, but those aren't in this bill, is that right? Are we going to hear them in this committee?
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Norris and Representative Koznick. Also kind of sticking with tax tradition, we will be hearing the my understanding is that likely we will be hearing the transportation omnibus bill in the tax committee when it is ready. So there'll be a chance to review those provisions, and they're not in the governor's sort of tax bill, but we will be hearing them under the transportation omnibus bill.
Anything further, Representative Koznick?
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think when when we look at, you know, we heard testimony that this is a moral document and all this, and I can see where they come up with that and say that, but it's very interesting because it's not in the bill here. You say it's a moral thing, but when you have and I presume that the governor is supporting that, you're taxing with the increase in the tab fees and the sales tax. You're doing the opposite of what you're claiming you're doing. You're hurting the lowest income Minnesotans by adding those taxes to them, and it's a pretty hard pill to swallow overall, but it's disappointing that those ideas continue to be floated when we have nearly $20 billion surplus, and then, yeah, factor out some of the inflation that we passed that bill, but there shouldn't be any tax increases even proposed with such a historic surplus, and we're just taking money from some to give to others, it seems like. But those particular taxes, the motor vehicle tab fees and the sales tax, are hurting the people that you purport to want to be helping, our lower income Minnesotans the most.
Anything further, Chair Gomez?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Koznick, and we'll be looking forward to having a full conversation about our hypocrisy on that particular issue when we hear the transportation omnibus bill. Can't wait. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, maybe the
Representative Koznick.
Maybe the committee chair would like to talk about the gas tax increase too. If I was having fun with that.
No, thank you.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just making another question for Commissioner Marquardt. Kind of just looking at kind of as tails and temporary spending, and you know, if you look out into the future of, you know, 4 or 5 years or 6 or 8 years, the tax increases versus the permanent tax relief or redistribution or whatever you'd like to call it, will this be a net gain to the state, or will people actually pay less over time because of this bill?
Commissioner Marquardt.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Wozinski, so just the net ongoing funding in the governor's tax bill is about one, tax cuts is about $1.4 billion. So I mean, you have the 600 and some million in increase on the capital gains, but the overall ongoing cuts are over $2 billion. So the net is about $1.4 billion net tax cut in the bill. So,
Representative Swedzinski?
Just the portions that are in this bill, not the other. I mean, if you're looking at, you know, so I understand what has the potential in this bill as it sits alone, but, you know, as you combine all things together, you know, if we just want to take it one snapshot of the pie, you know, that may be the case. And, you know, I think it is, you know, a big question. You know, I do have an amendment I'd like to talk about. I don't know how timing is. I'd like to offer it for some discussion.
Would you like to offer it now, Representative Wozinski?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Just because we're on the subject matter, and I think the timing would probably be appropriate, but you know, I'd like to move the A1 amendment before the committee.
Representative Swedzinski offers the A1 amendment. Representative Swedzinski, to your amendment.
So, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to members here in the House body, you know, I think, you know, we really have to be very careful on what we do here. The A1 amendment essentially just deletes and removes the portion of the capital gains part of the bill. And, you know, I'm offering this amendment up for discussion, and feel free to talk about it. I think discussion is a good thing. But, you know, we talked yesterday a lot about fairness and well, it's not right that people make money in the state of Minnesota, that job creators, you know, are essentially the enemy of the people in different ways. And, you know, I think that's just not true. I think that's a very bad attitude to have. You know, when you look at an economy, when you look at job creators at whole, you know, we have a responsibility to taxpayers. And, you know, one of the things I think about oftentimes are, you know, how we, you know, some of the biggest, you know, taxes that we levy on folks are sin taxes. And so, you know, from a regressive standpoint, we look at cigarettes and e-cigarettes and the taxes that we levy, or beer or wine. And, you know, oftentimes the arguments in favor of those types of taxes are to get people to stop doing things, right? Well, we need to do that so that they stop doing it, and or whatever that might be. And oftentimes, you know, we need to think about the use of those taxes in other places. And, you know, when we start raising taxes on capital gains and investment and job creation here in Minnesota, if you view it from that lens of using taxes as punitive to get people to stop doing things, you know, I'm afraid that they will. So whether you use taxes to raise the cost of cigarettes so people won't smoke, or you raise taxes to raise the cost of business and profitability and job creation and the ability to do that, you know, these things are not alone. And, you know, I think members of the public should realize that this is not just a well that it can always give. In good times and in bad, when you have a tax system that is more and more reliant on fewer and fewer people, you open up the budget, and the ultimate seismic shift within the budget and the dollars that come into the state government in a potentially very volatile way. And, you know, I believe most of the tax studies that I've read really focus that if you rely on taxes more and more on fewer and fewer people, the opportunity for the state and ratepayers and taxpayers to see giant fluctuations in that. We saw that in 2013 when we raised taxes on the highest income level. I mean, our lowest tax rates, you know, this bill is a tax bill that we talk about tax decreases, but yet it does nothing to decrease a single tax rate, whether you're the poorest of the poor or the richest of the rich. It does not affect your income taxes in the state of Minnesota. It does try to target farmers and families and business owners when they pass businesses on to the next generation, or attempt to here in Minnesota. But I'm afraid, you know, this policy has the chance of having businesses grow legs. When we think about tax policy, and we've talked about this in the past, Commissioner Marquardt, that, you know, when you are dealing with regimes and tax policy and regulatory environments, you know, you have three options that people essentially take. And it's three different things. It's you either fight a particular policy, so that you will fight it, you'll come to the legislature and negotiate things away so that you have a better opportunity to survive and prosper and compete. Because Minnesota's not alone, folks. Like, we have business owners who are competing with folks from other states and other parts of the world. And so you either fight for it, or the second option is flight. You have opportunities for flight. So that means you're going to pick up your business, grow legs, and try to leave. And oftentimes, you know, unintentionally, the least ability of businesses to move, large corporations, large businesses that oftentimes employ great vast amounts of people and create jobs and opportunity to raise families in our state, those folks have probably the most mobility. And like farmers, it's probably about as little as an estate. Grandma and grandpa saved and scrimped and try to pass that on, and all of a sudden now they're going to get hit in the pants with a potential large increase. How do they? It's very difficult to move a business like that across state lines. And then the third is ultimately fraud, and we see that often when the majority has been trying to raise rates on cigarettes, particularly. And we saw that with a bill that you brought forward 2 years ago with increasing the amount of folks at the Department of Revenue to enforce our tax laws on cigarettes, because folks were essentially pirating cigarettes across the border, selling them out of their trunk or whatever that might be, and essentially getting around the taxes on cigarettes. And so it creates an opportunity for fraudulent activity. And, you know, oftentimes when we're out of the norm, when we're a beacon, not necessarily for opportunity, but a beacon for punishment, whether it's cigarettes, whether that's income taxes, and in this particular case, as it involves the discussion around this conversation on this amendment to get rid of the cap of gains tax, it punishes the ability to have success. And, you know, coming out of really a disastrous policy set forth by Governor Walz by shutting down small businesses in downtown streets and making sure the big box stores are open, you know, there has not been any relief for those folks. There hasn't been anything, hey, you know what, we closed you down for a few months, your small little business, and allowed cars to just drive right past you so they could go to the big box store. There hasn't been any of that. Where are those things? And I haven't seen them. I would have thought that maybe Governor Walz, with his huge surplus, would have decided, you know, hey, you know, I did those folks wrong. I did them dirty, and I need to make up for that. I'm disappointed not to see that in this bill, in this amendment. I think at least touches on the fact that, you know what, there is still some unmended sores on businesses and opportunities that they've had, and regardless, you know, that's who creates jobs, small business owners. They don't just take this capital gain that they did when they sold it. And, you know, at least I would understand if it was a business that capital gains year after year after year had a same profit margin, you felt. But often what this also does is if you have a one-time sale because of a death in the family, that you're going to capitalize on that and say, you know what, hey, you know, there's not a carve-out, and I've always said in a tax like this, there should be a one- or two-time lifetime exemption for families that says, hey, you know, if this is a one-time event where you're selling a major asset within the family so that it can get to the next generation, that family should be completely and utterly exempt. But if this is a business that's operating day after day after day and having huge profits, that's different. But no, we don't. We don't exempt those people. And I offered the A1 up for some discussion and appreciate some thoughts. So thank you.
Members, we're on discussion of the A1 amendment. First to the author of the bill, Chair Gomez, if you'd like to discuss the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Swedzinski. I do want to say a few things. I'm kind of, if anybody was in the Ways and Means, the Finance Committee this morning, we discussed sort of our overall financial picture. And You know, one of the things that I think is really important for us to realize is like where our surplus mostly comes from. And we saw it when we were doing our introductions in this committee. If you'll recall, there were two slides when we were talking about revenue collection. And one was about corporate collections over the course of, I can't remember how many years it was. And then there was an individual income tax collections slide. And if you looked from 19 to 21, there's just this giant increase. It's like this, right? And so what that tells us is that during the pandemic, when tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans were out of work, when our frontline medical workers were, you know, working long hours, sometimes without PPP, taking care of people, making sure that the ill had care, when there were workers in the food system making sure that people got fed, when there was so much suffering in so many communities across this state, during that time, during those 2 to 3 years, the biggest corporations were making out like bandits. They had unprecedented increases in corporate profits during the pandemic. The other thing is the increase in individual income collections. And during that time, from 19 to 21, wages, people talk about, oh, it's the inflationary or wage inflation. Well, wages from 19 to 21 went up 7.7%. Capital gains during 19 to 21 went up 141.7%. The wealthiest people in this country during the pandemic extracted literally trillions of dollars. They made trillions of dollars in wealth. And so, you know, we collect $14.7 billion in income taxes. And so, you know, look, we're tax policy people. I agree. Capital gains taxes are a volatile source of revenue. That is just a fact, right? Like, look at, we're in accord on that. But to say that in the context of $14.7 billion in collections, a modest $600,000 in capital gain or $600 million in capital gains is going to upend the entire like system and drive people out of the state is just demonstrably false. That's not how this works. So it's absolutely inaccurate to say that anybody here is we've never said in this committee like people can't make money in Minnesota, that job creators are, quote, the enemy of the people. That is absolutely not what anybody is saying. Nobody is saying that small business owners or farms or anyone really is the enemy of the people. What we are saying is that in this economy, if you have made trillions of dollars as an aggregate of those highest, those wealthiest individuals in our country, if you've made trillions of dollars while people in our community were suffering, while we still haven't recovered in some cases, while our education system, for example, talk to a teacher, talk to a school psychologist. Like, we have real needs in our communities. It's not punitive to say that an economy that has richly rewarded the wealthiest and the largest corporations in this country, that we should be able to have some revenue to invest in that public good that created the conditions in which that wealth extraction took place. If you're a corporation that made out like a bandit during the pandemic while people were suffering and dying in our communities, you drove your stuff around on our roads that we paid for. Your workers, they were educated in our schools that the public good pays for, the tax dollars pay for. Resource extraction, job creation, it does not happen in a vacuum. It happens in the context of a society. And taxes are how we pay for public good in a society. So I understand what you're saying. I mean, we have different perspectives on this, perhaps. But we have to keep in mind why we have this surplus in front of us. And it's because of that unprecedented wealth that went to CEOs, to big corporations, to wealthy people who were invested individually in the stock market. And who did it not go to? It didn't go to people working in meat processing plants in Minnesota who were working in unsafe conditions, often without PPP, to make sure that people like us, who got to sit at home and be on Zoom and didn't have to go into an office and didn't have to go into our workplace, to make sure that we could still eat and feed our families. Who didn't share in that? In that? Our educators. Who didn't share in that? Our nurses. Our certified nursing assistants and our home health care aides and all the people who are caring for our elderly and our disabled folks in our communities. So, you know, it's not like punitive to say that, hey, when you have increased the capital gains 141.7% over 2 years, while things were really hard in our communities, that maybe above $1 million, you can contribute a couple extra percent. Thank you.
Continuing discussion of the A1 amendment, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll talk specifically about this, and I guess I'll start. Representative Swazinski gave sort of three ways that you could deal with the, you know, the people could deal with the higher capital gains. I'm going to add a fourth, and this is should the governor's, you know, tax increase pass. I think this is something that's going to happen. There are ways to get around some of this. Capital gains are created when things are sold, whether it's a business, whether it's a farm, whether it's stocks, whether it's whatever that. But they're a home, your home. It's when things are sold, and that's why I suspect the capital gains did go up 141% in the last 2 years. There were a lot of things sold. There was a lot of, but the stock market did very well. People sold their businesses. And I know a lot of people, lots and lots and lots of people who sold and left, and they're gone. They left Minnesota. A lot of people that I know. And I would believe very much that should we have the highest capital gains tax rate in the country, that you're going to see a lot more people walking out the door. There's a 1031. There are ways to still do this, to get around some of the through tax sheltering. Whether it's doing 1031 exchanges for property in a different state and then moving your residence, you know, I think you're going to see a lot of that. When you're asking people right now, you know, we've got about 45, about the top 5% of income earners pay about 45% of the state income taxes in this state, and under the governor's budget, the top 5% would pay 52%. It's a dramatic, dramatic tax increase on families that are already paying for the vast majority of all the state spending from an income tax standpoint. And there's a point when you get to a almost 14% state tax on top of your federal tax, where people just go, no. You know, it is, we are sending the wrong message to people who want to build businesses. You know, you can build the same business in Iowa and pay significantly less, or in Wisconsin, or in the Dakotas. And we're becoming an outlier here. We're becoming like California and Illinois and New York. And we saw what happened with California. They had $100 billion surplus a year ago. Now they have a $20 billion deficit. People have left, and people vote with their feet. And frankly, it's the people that are in the top income tiers who are the job creators, who have the greatest ability to vote with their feet. And I believe that we're going to see more and more and more of this. It has been happening. And the numbers, to me, play it out. When you see this capital gains number, like 141%, that means people sold that much more and probably left a lot of people. So I fear that this is going to accelerate jobs leaving the state. It's going to accelerate companies' headquarters leaving the state should this pass. And I would really urge my fellow committee members to really think about where we're going with this. So thank you.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Representative Swedinski. I think this is an important amendment to have because it's new, but it also is concerning. Representative Anderson talked about people walking out the door, and I think we all, if we're honest, know people in our districts that have family that have moved out of the state. I got a lot of rebar from a guy that packed up, and he left. He gave me about 2 days to come up and pick up all his rebar and everything because he moved his family to North Dakota. So it's actually true that people are walking out the door, but the real danger is in the discouraging of private investment for people that are here. And taking a look at some of the testimony, many of you, in my previous life, I had a real estate license. I still have real estate property. And so I'm looking at the comments submitted to the committee talking about the capital gains from the Realtors Association could significantly and adversely affect the commercial real estate market in Minnesota. Representative Gomez, you and I have been in your district. I've got some constituents, more than one, and one is pretty well-to-do. The other is working in a chiropractor facility or building that they own, so a variety of income levels there. We've got people all across the state that are investing in their businesses with commercial real estate, and the proposal to increase capital gains taxes could put Minnesota's commercial real estate market at a competitive disadvantage by discouraging that private investment. And reading that from the Minnesota Realtors, but that's true. I know a teacher friend out in, I'll say, Minnetonka. They bought a variety of homes. They had the house they lived in. You're a new homeowner. As it depreciates, you may have the opportunity to borrow against that asset. No hard cash of your own. Borrow against that asset on the line of credit to use to purchase a second home is what this teacher did. And then as those assets continue to appreciate, he's sacrificing some other spending choices in his life with his family, maybe sacrificing a vacation, purchasing an extra new car, or even a car, a variety of things to make the monthly payments. And he's doing that because he's providing for his family, he and his wife. I actually went to college with the wife and know that the guy is the teacher. But as their properties continued to appreciate, he took more equity out, bought a second and third property, and now he has about six. And if he was to sell it or got sick, he got skin cancer in the back of his calf. He liked to golf a lot. And, but luckily it's under control. But let's say it got worse, and as Representative Swedinski mentioned, a life experience happens and you have to sell these properties real quick. He's trying to provide for their family, or they are, and now we're taxing them more. He's made business decisions, purchasing decisions, investing decisions that no longer is going to be as attractive to do and to support the communities that he lives in. My constituents that are in your community will be disincentivized to continue to purchase commercial real estate or, in my teacher friend's case, just single-family homes is what he was doing. And so I think we should hit the brakes here and recognize that we are discouraging further private investment within our own state, and that's a problem because people aren't just going to walk out the door. They're going to stop, find other ways to invest or other states to invest in.
Representative Joy.
Thank you. And Chair Gomez and Commissioner Marquardt, we sit on close to the river in North Dakota, both of us, where we live. And we know today, Chair Gomez, you made some comments about trillions of dollars that were made during COVID. And I totally understand where you're saying with that. I do not shop at mass merchandisers. I shop at locals, small businesses. So this capital gains are small businesses. Walmarts, that little bit of money don't affect them, but it affects people like me. When you see the capital gains and we keep attacking higher earners or people like this, or we say trillionaires or what it is in Minnesota, we don't have a lot of them, but what we do have is entrepreneurs that start businesses that want to invest in Minnesota. I worked for a C-store chain. That matter of fact, a lot of you that live in St. Paul understand 501 Lafayette Road is now a jail. That was a creamery at one time, started in 1894. It's a convenience store chain. when that was approached to be bought, the owner came and said, we need to find land somewhere else. They want to put a jail there. And I'm like, oh, okay. So we went to Stillwater, beautiful area. Went to Prescott, beautiful areas. We landed that corporate office in Hudson, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. The reason why we're in corporate, that corporate office ended up in Hudson, because of tax reasons. So that's something that concerns me, is when we make decisions and we move forward with stuff like this, we move businesses across and we're like, well, you know, the big merchandisers are always going to be there. They're going to build wherever. But small business and entrepreneurs are moving because, you know, when you hit them with stuff like this, they're like, where do I build my next building? Where do I build my next office? And we're by the North Dakota, Commissioner Marquardt and myself, and I see it, and Moorhead's starting to see some growth. But when we make these decisions, will that stop? I don't want to see that stop. I want to see us grow. But just like that, I mean, I talk about the bordering, but then that's an example of where we could have built in St. Paul, we could have built in Stillwater, and that corporate office ended up in Hudson. So I think this is a good thing Representative Swiedenski is offering. And those are just things I think we got to consider when we do that. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joy. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Marquardt. Thank you, Chair Gomez. You know, I worry, too, sometimes about us sending the wrong message. And I think the wrong message is you get something for nothing. That's what I worry about. I worry about that we talk about the tax bill in a vacuum, that we, you know, have press conferences and talk about it in a vacuum, and we don't talk about all the other things that we need in our state. Those of you that sit on Ed Finance with us, you've heard all the testimony. You've heard the real needs that are out there. You know that costs money. If we even want to try to tackle the opportunity gap, try to get our school districts money to do their job, indexing the formula to inflation, putting a percentage on that, looking at the cross subsidy, that literally will take up almost all of the structural surplus. You know, I'm concerned about transportation, which is in a deficit spending right now. Those roads that we talk about all our businesses using to move their goods, they're deteriorating. I'm worried about our nursing homes that are taking care of our elderly. I'm worried about the folks that we can't find to take care of our kids. I'm concerned about our small business owners too, especially our small business owners on Main Street. I'm concerned about who's going to educate their families, who's going to educate their workforce, who's going to plow their roads, who's going to prepare the food that they eat, who's going to take care of them when they're sick, who's going to take care of them at the end of their life. Tax dollars are to support a system that takes care of all of us. And our decisions aren't made in a vacuum. It's all connected. And you get what you pay for. And investments we make right now go far, far into the future. And I just want us to also think about all that. And I know I didn't say it as well as Chair Gomez, but I fully have that in my heart, and it's honestly what's keeping me up a lot lately.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I have a question for the commissioner specifically, and maybe I should have read the entire budget bill. But the capital gains tax actually goes down by 10% in the 06 to 07 on the fiscal note. So it's 661 is the projected for the next biennium, and after that it drops by 10%. And do you know why? Is that because it's assumed that people are going to leave?
To Commissioner Marquardt, unless you'd like to have our nonpartisan staff weigh in on that. Or fiscal.
Mr. Chair, I just need to find my spreadsheet. Here it is. So, and this might be something for fiscal staff, but sometimes in the first biennium when you first include a change, it catches a half of another fiscal year or calendar year on the filings. And that, because I see the first year is 352, and that's the highest. And that's not uncommon because of the way the fiscal versus calendar year works. And so I think that might be it, but maybe Ms. Templin or Ms. Schill could
Yeah, Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. Yes, the revenue estimate for that provision, it is effective tax year 23, and there is a standard formula that is used to allocate fiscal years, tax years to fiscal years. So in the first year, the revenue raised is roughly more than one tax year. It's like 1.3 tax years. And so that's why you see that big, that higher bump in the first year. But after the first year, then the that bump then does decline. You see in fiscal 25 the full amount that is collected or is estimated to be collected with that proposal for that provision. So in the 24-25 biennium, the first year does reflect more than one tax year. It's about 1.3 tax years when you convert it to a fiscal year.
Okay.
And you can see in the tails for that provision, it does, the estimated revenue for that provision does increase slightly in fiscal 27. It starts to ramp back up again. And if I've missed anything, Mr. Williams may be able to add further information.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Norris and Representative Anderson, the only thing I was going to mention is I'm not sure if the Department of Revenue may have be baking in some of MMB's forecast assumptions about capital gains growth in the future. That may be another thing that's driving some of the further out year effects. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Representative Koznick.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out I do kind of actually agree with some points of Representative Chair Joachim. You know, the state does need tax revenue to fund certain programs and necessities of state government to help run an organized state. And right now we're in a $54 billion budget cycle, maybe slightly less than that. But the problem is that, you know, Minnesota currently ranks the sixth highest for personal income tax rate and second highest in corporate income tax rate. And now we're adding a capital gains tax rate on there. And so Minnesotans that are struggling to provide for their families, struggling to keep their businesses afloat and maybe start new businesses, they see where we rank, they might be more profitable and be more successful in a neighboring state or a state that has a lower income tax rates. But that's not even what we're doing here. What we're doing is we have a $17.5 billion surplus, and that even accounts for $1.5 billion in new inflation on the expenditure side, so really it's like $20 billion-ish. But to make it even more insulting for Minnesotans is that the governor is proposing a $63 billion statewide budget for the next biennium, which is a 25% growth in state government. And so when Minnesota families are trying to figure out how to provide for themselves, make sure that their kids have the best opportunities they can to do what kids like to do, mine like to play soccer, another one does track, a whole variety of stuff. Families want to go on vacations, fix up the house, take care of their parents that might need a little help because they're being taxed on their Social Security and their fixed incomes isn't reaching as far as they used to be. They're looking at this whole budget program and saying, why is state government growing at 25%? That's a huge, huge growth in state government. But yet we're asking them to pay higher taxes. We're introducing a new capital gains tax, which is what this amendment's about. But in other parts of the budget, we're increasing sales tax, 160% tax increase on driving your vehicle so you can get to work. Minnesotans are saying this is absurd, and it doesn't balance. There's a disconnect. We can continue to provide the services that the state can help with, especially education, taking care of our sick. But a 25% increase and having a historic surplus, but then we're gonna add more taxes to it and grow government at 25%. Minnesotans rightfully should be outraged. There's a disconnect there, and we've got a lot of time before the end of session, and so I hope, you know, I've been around a few cycles here, so I hope we get that number a lot lower.
Representative Joachim.
And we can get more money back to Minnesotans.
Representative Youakim's name was invoked, so we'll go to Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll make this quick. You know, one thing I've learned married to a math teacher is you can get numbers to say whatever you want them to say. Cost of government per capita has actually gone down in Minnesota over the years. The surplus that we have, most of it's one-time money because we had an influx of Fed money, and we've also had decades of underinvestment in some of our critical infrastructures, including our human infrastructure across the state. And the numbers you really need to look at moving forward is that structural surplus. And that is a whole heck of a lot smaller than $17.5 billion. It's a $5 billion structural surplus in the next two bienniums. And a lot of the investments we need to make are going to be ongoing for the future. So we have some tough decisions to make. And I would like to connect the dots for folks instead of having amplifying a disconnect. We should do more about education, and I'm sure Minnesotans realize the investments we need to make, because the ones I'm talking to tell me all the time. They want their kids to have lower class sizes. They want a nursing home attendant for their elderly parent. They want to be able to put food on the table. They want to see property tax cuts. Guess what? Cuts cost cash. So, like I said before, we have some big decisions to make here, but we all need to be very educated about the numbers moving forward. Otherwise, I am too concerned about how we're going to be leaving our future generation behind.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we think about rankings, I think it's really important to remember the point made by the chair and Representative Youakim about stepping back and seeing everything in the big picture. We have some of the best rankings when it comes to the strength of our economy. We have some of the best rankings when it comes to the health and wellness of our residents. One big exception is we also have one of the highest rankings when it comes to, and perhaps the highest ranking when it comes to, disparities between Minnesotans of different backgrounds. So we have apparently cracked the code that, in fact, it turns out that we can have a strong economy and healthy residents. And the only other state to compare to in that, as far as I know, is Massachusetts, another state that tends to be somewhat higher taxing. And guess what? Strong economy and healthy residents. What many of us are trying to do is to address a really key point there, which is how poor our rankings are when it comes to making sure that every Minnesotan shares in those benefits, both the strength of the economy and in health and wellness. But when we think about this, we've got to remember that ours is a state where folks have for a long time made the points that are being made today and have kept on saying, oh, this is going to be bad for our economy. It's going to be bad in various ways. Guess what? It turns out strong economy, one of the strongest in the country, and we also get to take care of each other, and that is the Minnesota way. Let's keep it up. Thanks.
Continuing discussion of the A1 Amendment, Representative Elkins.
Just real quick, I just pulled up the Minnesota Price of Government report for the last 20 years, and in the last report, which shows fiscal 2021, we're currently at a 20-year low in terms of the percentage of state GDP that is being collected in taxes by state and local governments in this state. So we have not been making the investment, and we have not been growing government by leaps and bounds as one would like us to think. We've not been making the investments we need to make.
All right. Chair Gomez, Commissioner Marquardt, anything further you'd like to add before going back to the author of the amendment? Commissioner Marquardt.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. So just on this portion, then I would, if I could, at the very end, just have a few comments towards the end, but just on this. So for Governor Walz, this is tax fairness. And think about this. Why should there be a tax preference based on the type of income you earn? And a lot of the rationale for the preferential rate for capital gains is very shaky at best when you look at past history and so forth. But why should someone who's made a paper gain on a sale but making income pay less of a rate, less of a tax rate than a plumber or a police officer or a teacher, a nurse that they earn on their wages? That there is just inherently a real unfairness. And for 3 years, Congress had all the rates the same, actually. So it's not like this hasn't happened. The other thing I would mention is, remember who we're talking about someone who's made at least $500,000 on a gain. or $1 million on a gain. And out of about 3 million tax filers, that's about 8,200 folks that would pay this additional tax. And on taxes, taxes don't go into a vacuum. They pay for things. And I'm not going to go into all those, but you heard things that it pays for. And one final thing I would say is anytime there's kind of been a tax increase, there's always this talk that there's going to be this huge flight. And I remember 2013 when the fourth tier was added, we heard the same type of arguments that folks are going to leave the state in droves. In 2013, according to the Department of Revenue, there were 60,000 filers who qualified for the fourth tier. In the latest stats I have, which is 2019, and with inflation, in 2019, 84,000 people qualified for the fourth tier. That's a 40% increase. So there's a lot of factors to look at, and there's other kind of comments I'd like to make, but on this one, it's just, to the governor, it's really a matter of fairness.
Thank you, Commissioner Marquardt. To the author of the A1 amendment, Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for a good quality conversation about something that I think we just have, you know, fundamental disagreements on. And, you know, while we look at different taxes and how they affect business and what our goals are with government, you know, I think we have a lot of big issues. And oftentimes, folks in the other party feel that the only way to solve them is to grow government. And we will see the ramifications of those growths and booming. And these things are not in a vacuum. They do happen on the world stage, especially in the Midwest, and potentially globally in our ability to compete. And our fear is, and, you know, the Democrats would say that it's an unfounded fear. We don't have to worry about it. Folks won't leave. We'll just make new millionaires, new people that are successful. And, you know, that's our goal. And, you know, we talked a little bit about achievement gaps and that ability. And, you know, we depending on what district you're in, some we spend $25,000, some we spend $8,000 across the state. But, you know, at the end of the day, is that going to solve the problem or just simply giving parents choice when there is no choice? There's a lot of ways to solve problems. Growing government, I don't believe, is one of them. And making a punitive tax structure in Minnesota to do business is obviously not one of them. If you look at the tax incident studies that we have, if I'm not mistaken, please correct me, nonpartisan, if I am wrong, but when you raise the cost of business, when you raise taxes on business in Minnesota, 45% of that tax gets passed on to Minnesotans. Well, often we hear that, saying, well, it's only 45%. Well, the other 45 to 50% get passed on to non-Minnesotans. So those are businesses that we make or individuals we sell across state lines. So oftentimes when we say it's an issue of fairness, when we say it's an issue of this, ultimately the customers pay. You know, corporations and businesses largely aren't taxpayers. They are tax collectors on business for government. And, you know, I want to keep that in mind that, you know, if you're looking at those issues through the lens of economic science, we often hear, well, we need to do all this and that, raise the cost of energy in Minnesota by $1,600 for families, and include the cost of goods over $4,000 per year for families because of the environmental science. Let's also look at the economic science, that these costs oftentimes get passed on to the consumer. And ultimately, I think from a competitive standpoint, we're going to suffer when it comes to opportunities for young people to gain employment by employers who maybe don't exist here anymore. And I think those issues should be real, and I think people should care. But with that, in fairness to historical tradition in the state of Minnesota here in the tax committee, at least in the shorter time within the last few years at least, and the courtesies we give to the governor's office and Representative Gomez, I'd like to pull the A1 amendment and appreciate the conversation. So thank you.
Representative Swidzinski withdraws the A1 amendment. We're back to discussion on the bill. I've got a few members in the queue already from before the A1 amendment. First up is Representative Olson B.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is directed towards Commissioner. I'm looking through this bill, and I'm seeing all sorts of different terms. And yesterday, you utilized the word tax cut quite frequently. And I'm wondering, so I'm seeing words, I'm seeing reimbursement, I'm seeing the word credit, I'm seeing the word aid, payment, I'm seeing refundable credit. A lot of these words that aren't, in fact, a cut. I'm seeing one thing that says subtraction. That has to do with the Social Security benefits, which is a subtraction. You know, when you're talking about, you know, taxing the rich and making the rich pay their fair share, I think that any senior who makes $47,000 a year would never, in fact, be identified as rich. Anyone who has a pension at all or a 401k also obtaining Social Security would fall into having to pay tax on their Social Security. But, you know, at least we're doing something there in the form of a subtraction. My question, but that subtraction actually is only to the tune of about $220 million, and you've got a capital gains tax increase here that's going to result in about $661 million. So my question is, where, in fact, are the tax cuts in this bill? Because you know as well as I do that shifting tax money to another individual is not, in fact, a cut. It's, in fact, a tax credit. You know, like, hey, good on me. I've got a kid under the age of five. I'm going to, you know, if this becomes law, I'd benefit from that. Good for me. But that's not a tax cut. That's a credit. Can you point me in the right direction? Because obviously I'm not seeing what you're seeing with the, when you're calling this some historic tax cut, this is more like a historic tax grab, because next year, you know, after these walls checks go out, we're going to see all sorts of revenue coming in. Can you show me where the cuts are, please?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Olson. Our filing season started January 23rd. If you haven't got one of these yet, here's the state M1 form. And by the way, we've got about 20% in right now, and we're getting the refunds out in about 7 days. Just a little ad here for the Department of Revenue. But so there's a lot of ways to cut taxes. One way is to reduce rates. And yet, if we were reducing rates, you also probably, in the language of the bill, would not see tax cuts. It'd just be numbers scratched out and a new number replacing it. But here is your income tax form, right here. And on the second page, line 15 says tax before credits. So whatever that tax is, it says now before credits. And on line 16, you got the M1C form, which is your non-refundable credits. And on line 22, you've got the M1REF form, which is your refundable credits. And you will add those, and that reduces the taxes you are going to pay. So when you get down to line number 26, it says amount you owe. So I've been somewhat surprised by this redefinition of a tax cut. A tax cut to me is when I'm going through this, that because of some things on here, and it could be a subtractions, also a tax cut because you're lessening your income, or a deduction, or doing with the rates, or credit, they're all tax cuts. So I think I kind of know where you're going, but with this, but this is a credit. This will hugely reduce taxes for folks. If, again, I mentioned a family of four with two kids under the age of five, they're going to get, even if they qualify for nothing else, they take the standard deduction, they got the dependent exemptions, and they've got an $8,000 credit. At $164,000, their tax liability would be $8,000. But now, with the credit, their tax liability will be zero. To me, that is an $8,000 tax cut, no matter how you slice it. So, and when you look at it, and this is why this is the largest tax cut in the history of the state by far, because if you just take three things, if you take the advanced rebate, which is $3.9 billion of an advanced tax credit, and you take the child tax credit, which is $1.1 billion in just this biennium, and the child dependent care, which is $548 million, another credit, that's what? $5.5 billion of tax credits. That's going to lessen the amount of taxes you owe. It is a tax cut. So you won't see it in the language because it's under credits. So you won't see the actual word of tax cut, but it's right there to the taxpayer, and they will feel that.
Representative Olson.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. I also would agree with you with the idea that a subtraction would be a tax cut, and I thank you for that. But what this bill is doing is it's picking winners and losers. I would be a winner because I've got children who are under the age of a certain age. My mom, in fact, would be a loser, even though I bring home a little bit more money than my mother does. She'd be the loser in this game that we're trying to play. I think that this in itself, you know, it's great to have these ideas of, you know, we want to help everyone, we want to help all people, we want to equalize things. But what we're doing is we're forcing the people who can most afford to leave. Question for you, and this is the last one I'll have. Have you done a study that would identify, you know, you told me that in 2013 we had actually 40,000 people in the fourth tier, now we have 80,000. Have you done a study that will show when people will start leaving, or are we just by guess, by golly, we say we'll know it when we get there?
Commissioner Marquardt.
So thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Representative Olson. First of all, to the migration question you just asked me. So according to the most recent demographer, well, there's 2015, there was a study, and then there was one with the demographer with House Research in 2018. And three quarters of the migration, in fact, a few years we actually had positive domestic migration, but when we've had negative domestic migration, three quarters, about 9,000 out of the 12,000, that was the average, are young people 18 to 24. And it's a very small, I mean, you hear it, you know, a lot on the Social Security where it's 65 to 69, but actually the 18 to 24, that migration's 10 times higher than 65 to 69. So, I've got to file this thick on migration. I mean, others who have been on the tax committee know this. I don't have it with me today, but it's very inconclusive. For a while, when Minnesota had, back in the 90s, a higher tax rate, we actually were bringing more people in on domestic migration. And then when the rates were actually lowered is when we started seeing. So, I mean, and there just isn't necessarily, there's a lot of different reasons why people are taxes part of it? Absolutely, it can play a role. There's no doubt about that. But it isn't to the role that it's sometimes made to be. There's just so many other factors. There's geography, there's weather, there's people's plight. And one study I had on migration, it was people, kind of families in the 30 to 50,000 income range that were moving out. And sometimes those folks might be the ones who are less committed to a community. They might have moved in, now move out, versus a senior who has lived there their whole life and least likely to move. So I will certainly give, taxes certainly can play a part, but there's a lot of different factors on that. And the other thing I would say is, picking winners or losers. The Governor Walz and Lieutenant Flanagan is very committed, and they say they are committed to making this the best state in the country for kids and families. And so does a huge percent of this tax bill, huge percent of the budget go for kids and families? Absolutely. That is a deliberate plan by the governors, because as we talked about yesterday, if you can reduce child poverty or close the achievement gap, all these other benefits to society are huge. So,
Representative Olson.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, for calling me a winner. I appreciate that with my kids. I think as a social studies teacher, so I could teach economics to 18-year-olds, not to someone your age, Commissioner. You know way more than I do. But there's a fine line. There's a fine line between not taxing enough and taxing too much. And I think that it's very dangerous for us to look at it and say, well, we'll know we've taxed too much when we see the negatives of it. And I think we're treading very closely to that. I would agree that our government needs to function. We have obligations that we need to provide to our constituents, to our citizens. But I fear we are very close to that line where we are taxing too much, and we will in fact see less revenue as a result of that. And we need to be very cognizant and very careful about this. And I know everyone on the other side of the aisle is going to take that to heart too, because you truly care in this of this state too. You care about everyone in the state, whether they make a lot of money or they make no money at all. The question is, where is that line and how close are we to it? I think we're very close with this.
Further discussion, members? Oh. Representative Anderson. You were in the queue from before. I don't know if you still have a question or comment.
It was answered before.
Okay.
So, thank you.
No problem. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we just had the A2 amendment, but I think we've kind of discussed the Social Security portions to some extent here in the committee, you know, whether we offer the A2 or not and then withdraw it. You know, I think it is just foundationally you know, a big issue that we are not doing full Social Security redemption. And, you know, this goes to the same cost. These folks aren't large corporate winners or big money folks. These are just folks that paid Social Security and would like to get their Social Security tax. And it was said yesterday during the debate that, you know, oh, we're just throwing money at these people. Well, at the end of the day, it's their money, folks. Like, these are taxes that have been out of their hands for most of their lives, and they're just simply getting a percentage back over time. And, you know, I would really just like to speak, you know, to the chair, Chair Gomez, and to the commissioner as well, that, you know, when we look at the unintended consequences, we look at the ability to, we have a worker shortage in large parts. Some of it's from the Great Quit and other things, but you know, we have an opportunity to kind of incentivize. We saw that about 4 or 5 years ago when we got rid of the tax on military benefits. And why did we do those things? We did that because those are exceptionally talented people that are used to moving, that have highly mobile lives, that are choosing not to retire here in the state. And we did that because we want to encourage them to be here, invest, give, work as paras in our schools, whatever that might be. And to some extent, folks are leaving because of our tax on Social Security and their ability to do that. Let's not put a black eye on the governor by not including this at the ultimate bill that goes, because I think everyone, almost everyone in this room said, hey, yeah, I support getting rid of Social Security tax, but I didn't hear a lot of buts. And I think by not including that, we're putting a butt in the conversation when quite frankly, there wasn't one during the campaign. And let's just do what's right. Let's get these dollars back into the people who actually paid. Social Security tax is a tax. You shouldn't be taxed on a tax. And that's what the amendment was about. We'll just save the process. If you want to discuss it, great. But I would just encourage that conversation to happen behind closed doors, wherever this bill gets written, to do that. So thank you.
Members, we've got about 7 minutes left. We've got two members in the queue. So I'm going to go to Representative Brand, Representative Anderson, and then we'll go to Commissioner Marquardt for closing comments, Chair Gomez for closing comments. Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is either for the commissioner or research, nonpartisan research. Why do we have a tax on Social Security benefits in the first place?
Mr. Williams, do you want to step up to the plate on that one?
Chair Norris and Representative Brand, there's lots of different ways to answer that question, I guess. I'd start by saying a portion of Social Security benefits are included in adjusted gross income. So, that flows through that's the starting point for our state's calculation of its income tax. Historically, there was kind of decisions made in the 80s and 90s about how much Social Security income to tax federally. And there's sort of a more complicated conversation about that so under federal law, you get a exclusion of at least 15% and up to 100% of your Social Security benefits, and it varies based on your income. And the way that those percentages were selected federally, sort of the underlying rationale for that has to do with calculations made sort of at the time about the ratio of amount of
tax paid into benefits received. And I have a publication on that that maybe I can send you after committee. That'd be helpful.
Representative Brand.
Mr. Chair, you know, there was some conversation earlier when we were talking about regimes and different policies with those regimes, and I'm just kind of curious to know if more more of the conversation has to do with the fact that maybe we were kind of spreading the wealth of the taxes around a little bit in the 90s and the 80s, and maybe it was a conversation about how do we change who gets charged and kind of spread that around. I'm kind of curious to know if there's more information about who, in fact, made the decision to tax Social Security in the 80s and 90s.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Norrison, Representative Brandt, Congress and the President.
Representative Brandt.
And just out of curiosity, who was the President when those decisions were made?
Mr. Williams, testing your history.
Chair Norris and Representative Brand, there was two decisions made to, there's sort of two tiers on the amount of Social Security income that's included in gross income federally. The first tier was established in the late 80s under President Reagan, and the second tier was established in the 90s under President Clinton.
Representative Brand.
Thank you very much.
All right. And Representative Anderson.
Thank you. As you said, Reagan was a former Democrat, so earlier. Thank you. I just, very briefly, I would encourage the Democrat majority as you bring your tax bill to consider the full Social Security exemption. I think it was something that was promised to our Minnesota seniors by just about everyone. Last fall, and well, in my area it was so, but by both parties. But I would encourage you to consider that. I do want to thank the commissioner and the governor for including rebate checks. I think I don't agree exactly with how it's laid out, but I think we also discussed that, and we've made those promises to our citizens. They've been overtaxed by billions and billions of dollars, and it's their money, and I think we should give it back. So I want to thank you for that.
Representative Swedzinski, I'll give you an opportunity if you want, as kind of the lead on your side, if you want to chime in before we go to Chair Marquardt.
No,
I was trying to avoid using that term.
Anyway, you know, I too, you know, I kind of spoke probably too much today already, but you know, I just think we do have some opportunities to do good in tax policy from a regulatory standpoint. You know, I would just urge the majority, you know, as Representative Anderson said, you know, what are the unintended consequences, but also view the policy as a whole. So not just a tax bill that's by itself, but what are the other things that's going to potentially, you know, affect? Well, you know, the argument was made today that, you know, well, we won't see businesses leave or go out. You know, the policies we have will affect in whole, you know, how folks view Minnesota. You know, we're already seeing that in public safety, and the fear to bring major conventions to our state for other fears. You know, from a business standpoint, if you're going to invest and you have a relationship with a banker, you know, where do those folks say it would be the most wise to put your investment dollars? You know, our businesses that we have don't just, the ones we have are the ones we have, and that's all we'll have. You know, what will these policies do to the next generation? And we need to keep those things in mind. You know, we don't, just because California did it doesn't mean we need to. And, you know, I would encourage members to really think about that as we move forward with tax policy and this. I do appreciate the way this committee is being run, though. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Swedzinski. Commissioner Marquardt, final comments.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And just a huge thank you on behalf of the governor and lieutenant governor for hearing the governor's tax bill. And the governor has said that this is the governor's tax proposal with his priorities, realizing the House majority is going to come up with their ideas and priorities. The Senate majority is going to do the same, and the House and Senate minority will have a tax plan. Mm-hmm. And all of that will be in the works. And As Representative Straczynski just said, the way this debate works in the Tax Committee has always been great. We have excellent, excellent debate, and very confident that at the end we're going to have a tax bill that is going to benefit Minnesotans. And, you know, you've heard the governor's priorities are kids and families, and that's what this represents. But again, a huge, huge thank you to this committee for hearing the governor's bill.
Thank you, Commissioner Marquardt. Chair Gomez, anything further on the bill?
Oh, I just was looking forward to some Commissioner Marquardt deep dives into his personal tax files, and I hope that we'll get more of that in the future. But yeah, just thankful for the good conversation today. I appreciate it, and thanks so much to Commissioner Marquardt for being with us.
All right. With that, the chair moves that House File 1893, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. House File 1893, as amended, is laid over for possible. It was amended last hearing.
Yes.
Yep. So, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Gomez, any road mapping you want to do for us, real quick?
I think we're not meeting tomorrow, right?
We are not meeting tomorrow.
Okay, that's the only map that we have so far. But
all right.
I'll let y'all know.
Next hearing will be next Tuesday. With that, our hearing is adjourned.